Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Riding the subways here in New York when I was in high school was many things, most of them deeply unpleasant and sometimes downright dangerous, but it was also a kind of moving modern art exhibit. Graffiti covered the trains, sometimes literally. I mean, you'd get on a train, the whole sides were spray-painted with someone's name in huge balloon letters, and it covered the windows and the doors, and you would have to wait until the doors opened so you could see outside and see what stop you were at. Now, I understood that most people found this annoying and ugly and a symbol of the city's decay. I understood that, but I also kind of liked some of it. And I clearly remember when Keith Haring's work started popping up. I didn't know who he was, but his writing, his art stood out. We remember him now as this high-profile, accessible American artist, but some of his stuff in the subway was really dark. There was one drawing where an advertising poster had been taken down and a new one wasn't put up yet, so there was this black rectangle on the wall, and on it, in white chalk or ink or paint, was a Keith Haring stick figure crouching on the ground, and looming over him was another figure, this one holding a cross out in front of him in one hand, and behind his back, in the other hand, a knife. Like I said, pretty dark, but it was unmistakably Keith Haring. Anyway, graffiti has largely disappeared from the subway. Instead, it's made its way into an exhibit called Rite of Passage, and we'll talk to the two curators, one of whom was also a pretty widely known graffiti artist himself. And those blank spots on the subway walls? Well, they're gone too, because that's valuable advertising space for movies and TV shows and the like. Although, here in New York in recent weeks, a lot of subway stations have been sporting ads for an opera. That opera is Two Boys, based on a true-life tale of hidden identity and tragedy that started on the internet and spilled over into real life. Composer Nico Muhly recognized that there was something modern, yes, but also something operatic about that story. Now 32, he is the youngest composer the Met has ever commissioned, and he joins us today on Soundcheck. Nico, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
So before bringing this story to the Metropolitan Opera, where did you find it? How did you find it?
It was one of those stories that was floating around in the early sort of cautionary days of the internet, when people were realizing that When parents hadn't quite figured out how to teach their kids to understand the difference between fake stuff and real stuff on the internet, there started to be a couple of crimes that, as you said, sort of spilled over from just people playing around into actual violence and, mm-hmm. and abuse. And this is one of the earliest ones where there was this complicated story of a young boy who was stabbed, and it seemed really obvious why he was stabbed, but all the reasons that were given to the policewoman were online reasons. And she, as a creature of the analog world, couldn't quite rationalize this. And
this is in 2001,
right? It happened in 2001. I started reading about it in 2002, 2003.
So without getting too much into the nitty-gritty of the story, because even if you know the story in advance, it can be kind of torturous to follow. Mm. We're talking about a case of kind of mistaken identity,
or deliberately, it's intentional costume using to gain something, and it's a classic sort of online hoax where you pretend to be a bunch of different people. But what's fascinating about a lot of these things is that sometimes an online hoax that has a specific end goal in mind, like for instance, give me money, that's mm-hmm. that's a really easy one. It's less emotionally kind of
fraught.
Dense, right? Yes, yes. Whereas something like this, it really was a case of someone just trying to not be lonesome and pursuing all these different costumey things and also linguistic ways to achieve that.
And was that for you? Was that the operatic part of it?
That indeed was the operatic part. I mean, that was the part that for me reminds me of, you know, reminds me of so much of opera where you I mean, Così fan tutte, which is playing at the Met now, is a great example, where it's the sense of you have a sort of vague idea that using a costume will help you know something more true about someone you love.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, and then of course the zooming out a little bit, it's more true about your own self, more true about your own feelings and your ability to express them.
So that plays out in the digital age in Nico Muhly's opera called Two Boys, which is at the Met until November 14th with a libretto by Craig Lucas and starring Alice Cooch. She's the detective who has issues of her own that she's working out.
Working through.
And Paul Appleby is the older of the two boys. He's Brian. And as he tells us in this excerpt, he is only 16.
I'm only 16. Look, I get up. I go to school and go to
Paul Appleby in the role of Brian in a number there, which goes under the name I'm Only 16. He begins by singing I'm Only 16, Nico, and then goes on to tell, he's telling the detective about this other world where he goes. And it's the world of chat rooms.
Right. And this is sort of an early point in the internet when there wasn't. So you have to remember that all of our modern conceptions of how this technology works, they're actually quite recent. I mean,
right.
Facebook is not that old, and Twitter is not that old. And it used to be when I was growing up, this is sort of, I would say, 2000, 2001, even 99, the places that you would go, there would either be message boards or chat rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And those were places where you could have multiple simultaneous voices in threaded conversations. And that's given way to a whole new series of technologies now that do similar things and chat protocols. But back then, that was a sort of way it was done.
Right. So what you have here is a grand opera. You're at the Met. It doesn't get much grander than that. But it's a grand opera telling a very intimate story. I mean, it's literally just a couple of characters. And
some of whom might not even be real.
Right. And most of the action is happening in online and not even on stage. So, you know, you've got a kind of tightrope to walk there.
It's a little bit of a tightrope. I mean, for me, the biggest problem-solving thing that Craig and I worked on immediately was we realized that one of the advantages we had with the grand opera format and with the grand opera space and with the grand chorus was that we, instead of having the chorus be sort of, you know, neighborhood gossips or townspeople, they could be the voices of online. And so what that enabled us to do was take advantage again of the scale of the thing, so that you could understand that even if you're living a very internal and lonesome existence in a kind of, you know, hideous suburb in the north of England when it's, you know, gray and cold and dreary, that there is the possibility of this sort of digital beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that we were – once we had solved that, then the scale of the thing became much more manageable. Memorizing this choral music is not the easiest thing in the world.
Well, I did want to talk to you about your writing for chorus, because over the years you've developed some unusual techniques for writing from multiple voices where you've introduced kind of – variables, you know, as opposed to here is a fixed score, every note, every syllable is written on this page. You've done things with like numbers and things like
right.
that.
Right. One of the things that I was interested in, you know, in liturgical music, actually, there it seemed to me that there was a big missed opportunity for creating really terrifying sounds of multiple voices. And you know, in the scripture, there are many examples of almost infinity number of voices speaking at the same time. So for me, in order to create that effect, and it started actually in my interest in sort of electronic music, but it moved out into sacred music and moved out also into this opera, was by if you write out the notes and the rhythms that you want, in a sort of global scale, and then ask each individual singer to invent a sort of schema by which content will be provided. So in a lot of cases, I find it a sort of emotionally compelling thing is if you ask people to say all the phone numbers that they remember, because now we don't remember phone numbers anymore. And I always tell the story that I've been with my boyfriend for like 6 years, and if you put a gun to my head, I would not know his phone number.
I don't know my daughter's phone
number.
It's
insane, right? Yeah. And it's like, you know what, and it's you know, it's not like we don't speak. It's just, I just don't know it because it's not part of the, it's not part of the
visual. You just press a button and there it is.
Right, exactly. And so, so then when you ask people to remember phone numbers or even to remember addresses, the ones that you do remember are from this, they're sort of relics of early childhood. And in a lot of cases, not ones that, there's always a sense that what was meant to have been just sort of archival information gets emotionally charged with distance and with memory.
Yeah. Now, there's an example of that in your album Mother Tongue, the piece Archive. Is this Abigail Fisher?
This is Abby Fisher, yeah.
And so she's like just churning out phone numbers and addresses and
stuff. Mnemonic devices. And, yeah.
And you know, you mentioned electronic music. There is a sort of electronic sound scape to this piece. This is from Nico Muhly. This is not the opera Two Boys, although you'll hear in a moment why we're playing it. This is from his album Mother Tongue. That is Archive, part one of Nico Muhly's piece Mother Tongue. And inspired by electronic music and the kind of the chattery sound maybe of Steve Reich and people like that, you get all of these voices. They're all Abigail Fisher here. So you've written the music, but she's supplying the actual content.
Right.
The phone numbers.
The phone numbers. And in some cases, I mean, I'm asking her for things that I know the answer to, like what's the alphabet backwards.
Right.
But in a lot of ways, you know, getting it wrong is more fun than getting it right.
So now how does this relate, you know, to the opera, to Two Boys, which is, despite your sizable experience in electronic music, a purely acoustic phenomenon?
Well, one of the advantages of having a huge chorus is that you can just sort of assign, you just say, all of you say the phrase, I love you, I love you, I love you, over and over again, and I'll give you the notes, and David will show you when they change. And
right. That's David Robertson, the conductor.
And basically, you know, one of the things that I was interested in, and one of the things I was so pleased with about Mother Tongue was that the trick that I wanted to have happen was that numbers and repeated phrases do take on an emotional meaning. There's a moment in the second act of Two Boys where this very kind of upsetting scene has just happened in real life, and we go back out online, so the camera sort of zooms out, and we see the entire projected text that was said to the young teenage girl Megan Meyer, who killed herself, who was by her next door neighbor's mother Laurie Drew, who this middle aged woman who basically pretended to be a 16-year-old boy to lure her into killing herself, right? And you know, she's saying, you should kill yourself, you're a terrible person. And one of the things that was so shocking to me about this case was that these were witnessed chats. These are things that other people had access to, and these are people that people's parents had access to, and these are people who should have known better. And so in this chorus, what I have is two people singing the actual text in a sort of, you know, notated way. And then behind that, there's a sort of halo of the rest of the Met chorus women singing little memory fragments of their own. So you get the sense that it's an observed crime. The text is sort of projected on these pieces of glass that are floating through liquid, and it's all kind of complicated.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, it's all like chat room English. So it's
right.
The letter U, you know, and things like that. And occasional misspellings, one of which will become a key sort of point in the unraveling of the mystery of Two Boys. But let's hear the chorus in action from Nico Muhly's opera, Two Boys.
I want to kill me.
The Metropolitan Opera Chorus and Orchestra, both splendid as always in the performance that I saw on Monday night, which was the premiere of Two Boys by Nico Muhly, David Robertson conducting. And Nico, those sort of stealthily creeping chords under the chorus, those come back at the finale of the opera.
They do, yeah. It's the same material, slightly you know, modified, but it becomes this sort of ritornello of depressing stuff.
It's a very taut kind of internal psychological opera, but it's also really kind of dramatically gripping.
Well, thanks.
The staging is, I mean, it's the Metropolitan Opera, but you kind of almost feel like you're in an experimental downtown theater, you know?
It's funny you should say, I mean, because Bart, who directed it, has directed so many kind of wonderful and huge and brilliant and traditional productions for the Met. I mean, his Barbara of Seville is like, you know, it's the one that they show to the kids in during Christmas, you know?
They won't be showing this to kids at Christmas. Two Boys is at the Metropolitan Opera until November 14th. Music by Nico Muhly, libretto by Craig Lucas, starring Alice Coote and Paul Appleby, and conducted by David Robertson. Bart Lecher is the director. In the lobby on Monday night, I saw James Murphy of LCD Sound System, who said he was really excited to see your opera. Richard Reed Parry of the Arcade Fire was there in the lobby. I mean, the rock and downtown worlds were both really well represented, you know, in a space where you don't normally expect to see those kinds of people. Is that a reflection of who you work with, the kind of musical circles you travel in?
Yeah, I'd like to think that, you know, anyone whose work I admire and anyone who likes my work would come. I mean, it's not, you know, it's the idea that the opera is a scary place is a sort of bizarre invention. It doesn't need to be, and it's definitely a place that where I've always felt comfortable, and you know, it's kind of a wild and crazy and very, very unique and very New York thing.
You know, it's funny you should say that. I brought my daughter to see the opera, and she was all concerned about what to wear because it was the opera. And you know how I dress.
Yeah, right.
I went like this. You know, all concerned. I was like, no, it's not like that anymore.
I mean, it can be.
But it
can be
like
if you want to be.
People.
You know,
yeah.
but the fun of it is that it's all coexisting. So if you want to turn up in a fur and jewels, you can totally do
right.
that, and everyone will be like, God, that's great.
Nice.
And if you don't, then no. It's not like a poison dart's going to come out of some pillar and take you out.
Oh, that would be a good operatic.
That'll be my
too.
next installation piece.
Now. Composers who are, you know, in the middle of a really massive project like this, I've seen this happen in the past where it will often spawn little kind of other works, shorter pieces, almost like studies or outtakes or things like that. Famously, The Chairman Dances by John Adams.
Right, comes from Nixon, right, exactly.
You have written recently a piece for Hilary Hahn called Two Voices.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any relation?
Not at all. Not
okay.
at all. That's just – that you know, if it's funny, the Hillary's piece, you know, when I was figuring out how to title it, it really is just because half of it is really low and half of it is really high, and it's just a duet. It's just a duet, but she has to do it. And I was watching her play that crazy Earl Koenig fantasy on YouTube obsessively because I'm obsessed with her, and I thought, okay, if she can do six voices for this, then she can do two for me.
Okay. So well, violinist Hilary Hahn will be joining us next week on Soundcheck to play some of her 27 encores, one of them by Nico Muhly, and we're going to hear the piece Two Voices. Nico's opera, Two Boys, is at the Met until November 14th. Nico, good to see you again.
Likewise, thanks.
By the way, if you want to read more about the Metropolitan Opera's production of Nico Muhly's opera Two Boys, check out my blog post at soundcheck.org. Up next, graffiti is being displayed on a different kind of wall, thanks to a new exhibition here in New York. We'll talk with the curator and a longtime graffiti artist. And later, lots of young bands come through our Soundcheck studio, but the four members of The Districts are just out of high school. Still, our staff love the album, and Districts will join us to play live after we check their IDs. This is Soundcheck.
When I rhyme, so pay attention. In New York, we make walls talk free expression. Beyond comprehension of the regular is deeper. Pain in my pocket, fat cap in my sneaker. Late night on a mission for self. I got the fever.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The British street artist Banksy has spent the month of October here in New York, leaving his literal mark all over the city in the form of much ballyhooed graffiti and other public art projects. But the idea of graffiti as art has existed here in New York long before Banksy arrived. It's the subject of a new exhibit that recently opened at Red Bull Studios called Rite, that's W-R-I-T-E, Rite of Passage. Sasha Jenkins is curator of the exhibit and editorial director of Mass Appeal magazine. David Chino Villarente is the co-curator of the exhibit and a legendary New York City graffiti artist. They are both here with me in the Soundcheck studio. Sasha, welcome.
Hi.
David, welcome back, as it turns out. You were on the show many years ago.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Sasha, the idea of doing an exhibit about graffiti, something that by its nature is ephemeral, you know, you do it and you don't expect it to last. That's a kind of strange balancing act that you're trying to pull off here.
Well, it's all a part of a bigger program. Rite of Passage is a program that I created with Mass Appeal and Red Bull, and it's sort of a celebration and exploration of the history of quote-unquote graffiti. Actually, the folks who first started doing it, they called it writing, and they called themselves writers because simply what they did was they wrote their names. The media eventually threw the graffiti peg on there because it's pretty easy to put all kinds of things in that sort of box.
Yeah. So let me go back to something you said, that originally this was writing. They referred to themselves as writers because mm-hmm. basically it was just you would tag your name and maybe a number that signified your neighborhood or your street, you know, whatever it was. But at some point you have people like Keith Haring coming along and, you know, he's got the babies and the dogs and all the other stuff. That's a different thing, although he was sort of lumped in with the graffiti artist when he first started appearing on the scene.
Yeah, well, I mean, Keith Haring doesn't appear until the late 70s, early 80s. But, you know, the time in between, you know, the emergence of a Keith Haring, the quote-unquote writing evolved greatly. It went from, you know, the interiors of subway cars being filled with names, and then it was like, well, what's next? Well, we got to write our name on the outside of the car. And then the exteriors got filled, and then it was like, well, what's next? There's so many names. Well, I'm going to have to go over some of this. I'm going to make my name bigger and bolder and wilder. And the whole idea of reimagining letters, remixing letters, which is sort of the backbone of, you know, hip hop mm-hmm, culture, mm-hmm. the idea of taking a music from another sort of sensibility and reimagining it, you know, writers did that.
Right.
And so before Keith Haring, there was a whole conversation and a whole language that was being developed. And by the time Haring arrived in the early 80s, you had this really vibrant downtown arts movement where guys like Jean-Michel Basquiat, who started out as a quote-unquote graffiti writer, mm-hmm. you know, would mix in with the Keith Harings of the world. So there was crossover in terms of, you know, Keith Haring associated with graffiti writers. I think he liked the energy of it. He fed off of it. At the same time, what he was doing was different. You know, he might fall under the category of quote-unquote street art.
Right.
And that's where all the confusion comes in. Everything just gets thrown into this big graffiti box, you know, and so I've been in the media like this whole week. Like, I've never done so many interviews in my life, and it's all about Banksy and like, so how angry are you, you know? And it's like,
are you guys angry?
No, I'm not angry, but people in the writing subculture get upset because writing is about letters. Largely, sure, you can have a character or some other rainbows and umbrellas if you want to incorporate it in your overall presentation, but the overall focus is on letters. That is what folks in the graffiti community or the writing community, that's what separates them from Banksy. Now, Banksy, his energy is similar in that he's doing something that's quote-unquote illegal, and he's mm-hmm, applying mm-hmm. his art onto surfaces that don't belong to him. And as we understand it, he is a former graffiti writer in terms of, you know, his initial foray into street art came through the eyes of someone who was interested in the culture of graffiti. But, you know,
right.
Your average graffiti writer who tags his name, no one's going to, like, try to cut that out of their wall to sell it for
to
a lot of money.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
the difference.
We're speaking with Sasha Jenkins and David Chino Villarente, the co-curators of Rite of Passage at the Red Bull Studios here in New York. And David, you as Chino have been tagging, you know, your name for a very long time. Did you think that was art when you first started doing it?
I didn't think it was art. Graffiti was a part of the backdrop and the landscape of New York City while I was growing up here in the 70s. I was always fascinated by it, the mystique of how this ended up on the subway and how these large-scale, amazing murals ended up on the side of the subway. And typically it was the characters that were borrowed from popular culture that appeared on the sides of trains that spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody painted a piece and they used Mickey Mouse from Fantasia, Donald Duck, or something that I saw in the Sunday comics, Beetle Bailey maybe. And I knew that character from the Sunday paper. I wasn't sophisticated enough to be able to decipher the letters that were next to it, but that was probably the first thing about graffiti that spoke to me.
And what was your medium? Did you start with markers, or did you start with spray paint?
I started with markers, and admittedly, I was primarily a bomber. I enjoyed getting up, was not interested.
Explain bombing.
Heavy saturation tags all over the interiors of subways. My preferred canvas of choice were the BMTs and IND lines.
Mm-hmm.
I lived along the A line in Brooklyn, and the CC train stopped there, as well as the GG, or the G train as we know it
right.
now, and the C train.
And didn't I see some of your work on the J train as well?
It crossed over, yes.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
the beauty of hitting the Coney Island yard.
So that's bombing, and then there was burning. I mean, if you were sitting in a burner, you were sitting inside a subway car, the windows and doors of which were completely covered from the outside with
yes.
usually a single kind of mural.
Yes, and it was impossible to see out of the train, so you had to wait for the doors
right.
to open in order to see what stop you were at.
And some people really got upset by that.
That is true, and I can understand why now as an adult. But at the time, it was a fun, youthful movement,
yeah.
a very unique New York pastime that brought people together in a very special way here in New York City, especially during a time where there was still lots of segregation in New
yeah.
York City.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Sasha, the idea of graffiti as one of the four elements of hip-hop, along with rap and turntable and breakdancing, you know, that happens, there's already graffiti happening in the city. How does it get kind of pulled in to become such a kind of a pillar of hip-hop culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think writing culture predates hip-hop culture. I mean, the first recorded hip-hop record didn't happen until 1978. I think the energy and the attitude of the graffiti writer, for instance, Kool Herc was a graffiti writer before he was the DJ.
Mm-hmm.
The attitude, you know, the idea of this is who I am, I'm here, I'm saying things, recognize me, that's what rappers do, you know? So I think the energy of what writing is and graffiti is predates hip-hop. In 1980, there was a pretty pivotal piece that was written in the Village Voice that kind of put all of these things together in one nice, neat package. And breakdancing and graffiti and DJing were all happening independently before that article, but the common thread was youth and energy
mm-hmm.
and youth energy and sort of the climate in New York City that created, you know, this youthful reaction to what was going on. So, you know, you'll have a guy who was a DJ who wrote graffiti, or there was a graffiti writer who used to breakdance. You know, there are a
right.
lot of things. And I always say that graffiti is just a part of the cultural experience back then if you were a young kid in New York City.
So for you, David, you know, did you feel kinship with the early beatboxers and the early DJs and the early breakdancers? And
most of my friends breakdanced at school, or were B-boys, rather. Some of the guys I went to school with were MCs. And so I had friends that were practitioners of hip-hop culture. We all hung out. It was all what was happening at the same time. But talking to some of the pioneers of the culture, they were listening to Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and Black
right,
Sabbath and all
right.
sorts of other things while they were painting trains. So I understand how it's lumped in with hip-hop,
yeah.
but I also understand that it has its roots outside of hip-hop.
Well, now, you get a shout-out in this song by KRS-One, Out for Fame. You'll hear Chino mentioned in this song that is focused on graffiti as a pillar of hip-hop.
All graffiti on its whole top. got 25 cans in my knapsack, crossing out the wick-whack, putting up my name with a fat cap. Suckers that want to be in my face, I just slapped that. Big respect to artifacts, Fat Joey cracking, Mac and Bio and Brim come again with BG-183. Recognize me with the mad colors. I'm a fiend for spray paint. Laugh if you wanna. I really care if you ain't, cause you don't know me, see, and I don't know you. But I do know Coke too. He be hitting walls too. It's the underground community of what we call writers. Worldwide burners getting hotter, getting brighter. What up, Nicer? What up, Mesa? What up, Chino? Master Ace in the place with the bass. You know we know my man Reekin. My man Zor taught me how to draw in the yards of the 5 train in the 4. So when I'm on tour, I represent the hard.
Out for Fame from KRS-One's 1995 record called Jive. And when he says, what up, Chino? Well, Chino is here with us, David Chino Villarente, the New York City graffiti artist and co-curator with Sasha Jenkins of Rite of Passage, an exhibit at the Red Bull Studios here in New York every Saturday from now until November 23rd from 1 to 5 p.m. And Chino, when did you, David, when did you start? How did you pick Chino? When did you start using that as your tag?
I probably started dabbling or doodling in the restrooms of my elementary school. Mm-hmm. I was writing Dave. I was writing D-E-E with a cloud, a small lightning bolt. When I got to junior high school, I started meeting guys that were a little bit more experienced at graffiti. But my real education didn't start until high school. And then I found myself in an atmosphere with guys that were already writing on subways.
So, Sasha, first of all, did you have a handle? Did you have a tag?
When I was a kid, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Like, I always, I use the professional skateboarding model as a reference. Like, there's a handful of guys who are really great skateboarders, mm-hmm. and there's a handful of guys and gals who became really great in the, you know, writing community. You know, Dave is one of those guys who stuck out. I was just one of the thousands and thousands of other kids who had a tag, who wrote, and who was really, you know, immersed in it. And, you know, when I was 17, I published my own zine devoted to that, to graffiti, and that kind of got me into media and publishing magazines and writing for magazines like Rolling Stone and Spin, et cetera. So my passion for it has propelled me to do a lot of really interesting things.
And David, has the city changed in the way it sort of treats graffiti? I mean, the days of the burners, you know, those are long gone, aren't they?
They still exist. There are still guys from that of the era that are still practicing graffiti today. But the penalties for graffiti have increased considerably. And I got caught writing on trains maybe 3 or 4 times as a kid, and it really was a slap on the wrist.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't an arrest. It was a misdemeanor charge. We cleaned subways at Church Avenue for 2 or 3 Saturdays out of the month. And, you know, after 6 months, it was expunged from your record, and you could write graffiti again. But what it did do was put you in an atmosphere with other guys from around the city that were caught writing graffiti in different places. And your knowledge of where to go expanded considerably by meeting these guys at community service.
So basically, the court system put a community center together for emerging graffiti artists.
A think tank of sorts.
So, but now it's a felony, is that right?
It is a felony. And, you know, I think that it's important for the people that are in charge of arresting these people to pad the stats and make it really look like they're doing a good job. When I was a kid, ballpoint pen on a subway map wasn't an issue, or a subway poster, rather, while you were waiting. Now they're going to take you in for no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And so it's a very different, there's zero tolerance for it right now, whereas when I was a kid, you could get away with a lot.
Is there, Sasha, a sense of nostalgia for a dirtier city, a city where you could get away with this kind of stuff and get away with a slap on the wrist?
Well, I mean, I think the graffiti thing, to a large extent, it's not nostalgia, which goes back to my bigger argument. The world has embraced it. You go to Budapest, you go to Australia, you go anywhere around the world, there are vibrant scenes where people paint trains or they paint walls. You know, for a lot of people, it's 1984 around the world. So
you don't mean George Orwell 1984?
No, not
you're just,
that
you're just picking an earlier year.
Yeah, 1983,
okay.
If you want.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think that it's not nostalgic. It's a language that was developed here that's global. And unfortunately, the United States has been really slow to embrace it. I mean, Red Bull is a European company.
Right.
you know, and they're smart enough and cool enough to understand that, like, what we're doing is important.
What do you guys make of the 5 points where they're, you know, the warehouse that's completely covered in graffiti, and now the owners, who've been very kind of supportive of the artists who are there, now want to, you know, demolish the building and build something else. David, what do you think?
I understand both sides of the argument, but people have, they need an outlet here in New York City. And I think that 5 points has been a great example of, if you give people an outlet, you know, I think the first concern was, if we invite graffiti writers here, the entire neighborhood will be saturated with graffiti. And flash forward to however many years later this building's been standing there, more than almost 20 years maybe, that's not the case. And you give people an outlet and they'll go there. And if you give them a skate park, they might not skate on the rails in front of the court building on the weekend. So I think it's a very important thing. And it's sad to see it go if it does go. They're putting up a good fight, and hopefully they'll be able to keep it open.
But it is looking like, you know, it's the owners are well within their rights, and they have been good landlords to this crew of graffiti artists.
Yeah, I mean, they were nice enough and sophisticated enough to give, you know, the artists this kind of opportunity. It created great awareness on the, you know, of the building, and, you know, did a lot for the community, and they own it. You can't really stop them from saying, hey, I want to make money now, you know. What can you do?
All right, so the exhibit called Rite of Passage is open at the Red Bull Studios here in New York on Saturdays, 1 to 5 p.m. every Saturday through November 23rd. You get to see some of David Villarente's work as Chino. He and Sasha Jenkins curating this exhibit. Guys, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, a new artist we think you might like, the Philadelphia band The Districts, joins us to play live. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Three of the four members of this band, The Districts, are fresh out of high school, but the young band is already turning heads. Earlier this year, the Pennsylvania-based group made it to the front page of the hugely popular social news and entertainment website Reddit with a live version of this song called Funeral Beds. Now they're here in our New York studio, and they're going to play live for us. Here is The Districts with a song called Lila, live on Soundcheck.
Makes me feel like I'm fighting. wrong. When I see you turn me go, I know I need your love to stay.
The Districts is the name of the band. Live performance here in our New York studio on soundcheck of a song called Lila, which you will find on the District's 2012 album called Telephone. The members of the band include Robbie Grote on voice and guitar, Mark Larson playing guitar, doing some backing vocals, Braden Lawrence behind the drum kit, also doing some vocals, and Connor Jacobus on the bass. And Robbie joining me here at the microphone. To you and the rest of the Districts, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
I mentioned introducing you guys, the whole Reddit thing.
This
for folks who don't know, this website where you post stuff and people give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. So when you guys made it to the front page of Reddit, what I didn't mention before is that it was with something that had been sitting there for like a year, right?
Yeah.
So what happened?
I guess the one guy that we filmed this thing with, they have a little studio in Philly. We filmed it with them, and they'd posted on Reddit like a while ago, and just for the heck of it, he just posted it again, and I don't know, it was just pretty random. It just blew up, kind of.
So you guys, were you taken by surprise?
Yeah, I'd say so, because it was kind of like didn't think about it that much, because it happened so long ago, and then it's kind of confusing. Surprising,
right. Are you guys Redditors yourselves?
I'm not. I don't think any of us are, no.
No. Lots of shaking heads. No Redditors. Well, it's certainly, got the name of the band out there. Where does the name of the band come from? The Districts.
We don't really have a great story for that.
Make one up. You're going to be getting this question for a while.
Yeah, it was kind of had some names floating around and kind of... We had, our first show coming up in, 2 weeks. We kind of just had to make a pretty hasty decision.
Yeah, I've heard that story many. We had a gig coming up. We needed a name, and so came up with whatever. So now you guys, I know Mark is a year ahead of you all in terms of graduating from school. When did you all start playing together?
I guess, early high school, about 4 years ago or so, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was there a gig? I mean, was there a reason why you all got together?
Me and Connor have been trying to start a band for a while, and I knew Mark, he was in another band, and he knew Braden, and we just wanted to start a band, and there was this little coffee house show thing coming up, so we just kind of threw everything together last minute.
And was it sort of did you figure out pretty quickly what you were going to be when you grew up musically? Did you know the kinds of music you wanted to kind of stake out for yourselves?
Not really. We kind of started playing Jimi Hendrix and classic rock covers because it was the only thing we could all agree on. Because we all hated each other's other tastes in music. And we slowly started to agree on more music as we hung out more, and it kind of became what it is, I guess.
Yeah. And what is that?
Good question. I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of hard to describe yourself,
it is.
I guess.
But it does have, your voice puts me in mind of a number of singers from maybe late 60s, early 70s. Is that still kind of a musical touchstone for all of you?
I'd say that period? Yeah, I think we all like a lot of music from the 60s and 70s, and then also a lot of newer music, too. So it's kind of it's definitely still an influence.
Right. So you guys have played through high school. Now you've all graduated from high school. And what happens next? Going to college, or is there just too much touring to do that right now?
Right now we're just living in Philly and playing music. At college, we're not sure if we'll go at some point or not. We're actually planning to go and then just decide we want to play music and decide to defer or whatever.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right. You want to do the song Long Distance for us?
Sure thing, yeah.
All right. The band is The Districts, based in Philly and here in our New York studio today, playing some music live for us. They're playing live on Tuesday, November 5th, at the Rockwood Music Hall here in New York as well. The album Telephone is out now. They're working on a new one, but here's a song from Telephone called Long Distance. Thank you.
become the stone that stole me from the ground. The water seeps below, it's right in my heart, searing smile. Stay out of the sun, watch the dreams let slide.
Song is called Long Distance, another live performance on Soundcheck from the band The Districts out of Philadelphia here in our New York studio. And Telephone is the name of their 2012 LP. Now, you guys are, you're based in Philly, but you're originally from Lancaster, right?
Yeah, yeah, like Lidditz. It's like a small town outside of Lancaster.
Mm-hmm. And so how big has the move been to go from there to Philadelphia? I mean, I know it's only like an hour, hour and a half, but I mean, how big a lifestyle change is that?
I don't know. I mean, definitely a little bit. We've been like playing in Philly off and on for like the past probably like year and a half, 2 years. So it was kind of a little more gradual just because of that. Like we were kind of used to being in the city and stuff, and we knew our way around fairly well, I guess. But but yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lot different. It's a lot louder and a lot busier and stuff. But.
All right, well, and here you are in New York playing for us on Soundcheck today, Tuesday, November 5th at Rockwood Music Hall.
Yep.
The album and the two EPs are already out. There's another in the works. The band is The Districts. And, guys, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for coming in and playing for us.
Thanks so much for having us.
When veils their mother's daughters made us scared to be alone. I'm just shivering, shaking, I'm scared to go on.
Tomorrow on Soundcheck, John Lithgow has played an alien on Third Rock from the Sun, a serial killer on the Showtime series Dexter, and a dance-hating pastor in Footloose. Tomorrow, he joins us to talk about his latest role as a real-life author of a children's book. It's called Never Play Music, Right Next to the Zoo. Plus, John Paul Keith has played a lot of roles in his career. The Memphis-based roots rocker joins us with what he's calling his best album yet. Plus, a look at the new comedy about a teenage punk band trying to make it in the 80s. It's called Losers Take All. That does it for the show today. Remember, there's a lot more where this came from online at soundcheck.org. And follow us on Twitter or Facebook to get the latest updates about our live 2 p.m. in-studio webcasts. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff with Alex Kappelman, Amy Pearl, and our intern, Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us. This is Soundcheck.